A charismatic leader, a fantastical premise, a group of devoted followers, a shared vision. Get ready. It's time to talk about cults, part two.
Listening to You Totally Made That Up, a bi-weekly history podcast where we discuss the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from way back when. And the catch is, we like the ones that have some sort of supernatural, paranormal, spooky, woo-woo elements to them. But they're all true, even if those parts are only true to the people who lived them. We don't do the lore says or the legend goes. We like dates and names and all the facts we can find. And my name is Nash.
My name is Tiff.
We are your hosts. Keep listening after the stories to hear the outro. That's how you'll learn where to find us on social media, how to get in touch with us. And we very, very, very much love hearing from you. And something else that we love is getting right into it. So here we go. Let's carry on with our discussion of absolutely crazy cults. And we hope you've enjoyed it so far. Now, in part one, we went over the basics on what cults were and what defines them. So if for whatever reason you're listening to these out of order and you're curious, go back and listen to that intro. My story for you is one that I've been saving up. It is convoluted, it is hysterical, and I cannot wait for you guys to hear it. I mean, you're not ready. You may think you're ready, but you're not. This is bananas. Tiff, do you have any questions, comments, or concerns?
Not yet. I'm sure I will.
Oh, but yes. And so, I take you to January 17th, 1706, Colonial Boston, the American colonies, because on this date, in this place, one Benjamin Franklin is born. Yes, that Benjamin Franklin, one of America's founding fathers. For our listeners across the pond, and we have a good chunk of y'all, to sum up quickly, what we mean when we say a founding father is, and I'll just quote here because it's straightforward, they were, quote, a group of American leaders who united the 13 colonies, led the war for independence from Great Britain, and built a frame of government for the new United States of America during the latter decades of the 18th century. The group came from a variety of social, economic, and ethnic backgrounds, as well as occupations. So, there you go. Now, let's go over old Ben's life here for a minute, because he is a fascinating human being. He is the eighth of the 10 children of Josiah Franklin and Abiah Folger. Josiah was from the village of Ecton, Northamptonshire, England, and he immigrated to the American colonies in 1682. But before that, he'd been married to a woman named Anne Child. And speaking of child, they had eight of them. So for those of you keeping count, when all was said and done, Josiah went and had him 18 children total.
Oh.
Josiah liked to fuck. Abiah was from Nantucket, Massachusetts, and there's a Nantucket fuck it joke in there somewhere, and they married in November of 1689. Josiah made a living as a candle and soap maker, and Abiah was a baby factory. They were members of the Congregational Old South Church in Boston and raised the children in the Presbyterian faith. As far as their thoughts on their son Benjamin, once he started becoming involved in all manner of stuff, we will get to that. Amongst those thoughts were that Josiah wished Ben would have become a minister and Abiah disapproved of his involvement with the Freemasons. This is adorable, and you'll see why in a little bit. Backing up to his childhood. Given the amount of mouths to feed and that whole soap and candle jam, they weren't exactly wealthy, as you can imagine, and they couldn't send Ben to school but for about 2 years from when he was around 8 to 10 years old. But he knew how to read, and he read constantly, and gradually he became a really impressive writer. He, quote, made up for his lack of schooling by spending what little money he earned on books, often going without food to afford new volumes. He also honed his composition skills by reading essays and articles and then rewriting them from memory. I mean, holy moly. When he's 12, he started apprenticing with his older brother James, who is a printer in Boston, and by the time he's 16, his essays are getting printed in one of the newspapers James published, and he did it under the pseudonym of Silence Duguid, because yeah, I mean, who's going to read the thoughts of a 12-year-old? And apologies to any 12-year-olds listening, but why are you listening? Something I love, though, is that Silence Duguid, a woman, specifically, quote, a fictitious widow who offered homespun musings on everything from fashion and marriage to women's rights and religion. The letters were hugely popular, and Mrs. Duguid soon received several marriage proposals from eligible bachelors in Boston. Okay, so at 17, he leaves that gig and strikes out on his own. He goes to Philadelphia, starts working as a printer. When he's 18, he goes to London, gets into the printing business there. And I don't know about y'all, but I'm already both impressed and overwhelmed by this kid. He gets a lot of experience there, and 2 years later, in 1726, he's back in Philly, and this is when things really take off. He opens his own print shop, very successful, and his clients are nothing to sneeze at. I mean, he's not just cranking out newspapers and books. He's also tapped to print government pamphlets and currency, and my guess is that this is the start of his establishing relationships in the political realm. In 1730, he starts shacking up with a Deborah Reed, and she's essentially his common-law wife because her husband had ditched her, but divorce wasn't a thing, and there were bigamy laws, so they couldn't officially get married. They do have a son, who dies at 4 years old, and a daughter, who lives till adulthood. He also had another son, and I can't tell if this was while he was with Deborah or before, because this kid was born in 1730, which is when he started up with her. But anyway, point is, the kid's out of wedlock. But Ben didn't ditch him or something. He carried the Franklin name, and Deborah actually helped raise him as one of her own. Now, throughout the 1730s, Ben's really getting involved in community stuff. A great thing he did was creating a library, and this was a big deal because it came at, quote, a time when books weren't widely available in the colonies and remained the largest U.S. public library until the 1850s. He also established the first fire company, a police patrol, and a branch of the American Philosophical Society, which we talked about in a past episode. He organized the Pennsylvania militia, raised funds for a city hospital, advocated for a program to pave and light the streets, and was part of the crew who established a college, the Academy of Pennsylvania, which later became known and is known to this day as the University of Pennsylvania, which, interestingly, is one of the sources I quoted talking about cults in the intro for part one. He was also part of the crew that kicked off the colonial postal system, was appointed the postmaster of Philly, and then later in his life, he was postmaster general for the entire country. All of this stuff isn't what he's really super famous for, though his initial fame and financial boom came in 1733 when he starts up Poor Richard's Almanac, which ultimately ran until 1758. And here's a cool factoid, quote, "The Almanac became known for its witty sayings, which often had to do with the importance of diligence and frugality, such as early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise." All right, so let's speed run some more interesting tidbits on our friend Benny, because if we don't, we will be here for days. His list of accomplishments are so vast. So I've just chosen some that caught my eye the most. And instead of saying quote before everything, just understand that for this list, I'm both summarizing and quoting from two History.com articles, one assembled by various editors and one by Evan Andrews, and I'll be linking you to both of those in show notes. And for some of these, we're jumping forward in time, past the time period that I'm going to focus on for the main part of the story, but we'll swing back around. Okay, so he spent half his life in unofficial retirement. By 1748, at 42, he was rich enough to hang up his printer's apron and become a gentleman of leisure. Franklin's retirement allowed him to spend his remaining 42 years studying science and devising inventions such as the lightning rod, bifocal glasses, and a more efficient heating stove. And actually, we talked about the Franklin stove in another episode. It was ultimately a bust, but it really was popular for a time. On the subject of electricity and other sciencey stuff, in the 1740s, he conducted experiments that contributed to the understanding of electricity and, as said, invented the lightning rod, which protected buildings from fires caused by lightning. In 1752, he conducted his famous kite experiment and demonstrated that lightning is electricity. He coined a number of electricity-related terms, including battery, charge, and conductor. In addition, he studied a number of other scientific topics, including ocean currents, meteorology, causes of the common cold, and refrigeration. He designed a musical instrument used by Mozart and Beethoven, the glass armonica, an instrument designed to replicate the sound that a wet finger makes when rubbed along the rim of a glass. He made his first prototype in 1761 by having a London glassmaker build him 37 glass orbs of different sizes and pitches, which he then mounted on a spindle controlled by a foot pedal. Franklin would later write that, "Of all my inventions, the glass armonica has given me the greatest personal satisfaction." More on inventions and to do with his love of swimming. One of his first inventions was a pair of wooden hand paddles that he used to propel himself through the Charles River, and he wrote of once using a kite to skim across a pond. While living in England in the 1720s, he displayed such an impressive array of swimming strokes during a dip in the Thames that a friend offered to help him open his own swimming school. Franklin declined the offer, but he remained a proponent of swimming instruction for the rest of his life. He liked working in the nude.
Okay.
In his time, baths in cold water were considered a tonic. But Franklin believed the cold was too much of a shock to the system. "I have found it much more agreeable to my constitution to bathe in another element. I mean cold air," he wrote in a letter. With this view, I rise early almost every morning and sit in my chamber without any clothes whatever, half an hour or an hour, according to the season, either reading or writing. He created a phonetic alphabet. In 1768, he embarked upon a project, as he put it, to give the alphabet a more natural order. Annoyed by the many inconsistencies in English spelling, he devised his own phonetic system that ditched the redundant consonants C, J, Q, W, X, and Y. Are they really redundant? But okay. I mean, I find them useful, all of them. And added 6 new letters, each designed to represent its own specific vocal sound, but later scrapped the project after it failed to arouse public interest.
You think?
Yeah. He was a fashion icon in France. In 1776, the Continental Congress sent Franklin to France to seek military aid for the revolution. The 70-year-old was already world-renowned for his lightning experiments. The French even called their electrical experimenters Franklinists, but his fame soared to new heights after his arrival in Paris. He capitalized on the French conception of Americans as rustic frontiersmen by dressing plainly and wearing a fur hat, which soon became his trademark and appeared in countless French portraits and medallions. Women even took to imitating the cap with oversized wigs in a style called coiffure à la Franklin. When Franklin later traded the fur cap for a white hat during the signing of the 1778 treaty between the French and the United States, white-colored headgear instantly became a fashion trend among the men of Paris. And hang tight, his gig as an emissary to Europe is the period we'll be coming back to. But most importantly, about his time in France is, of course, that treaty he helped negotiate. It was a military alliance with America and went on to provide soldiers, supplies, and money that proved critical to America's victory in the Revolutionary War. And he actually stayed in France till he was about 81, till 1785, and when he came back, that's when he became a Continental Congress delegate. And, on being a founding father, he is the only founding father to have signed all 4 of the key documents establishing the United States: the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Alliance with France, the Treaty of Paris, establishing peace with Great Britain, and the U.S. Constitution.
I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted just hearing all of this.
I know.
My God.
Oh, I'm going to exhaust you. He's going to exhaust you. You're going to... Oh, get ready. Talking more about the political stuff, at one point, people wondered if he was a British spy. As my source puts it, he was a reluctant revolutionary. He was among the last of the founding fathers to come out in favor of full separation from Britain, instead pushing for peaceful compromise and the preservation of the empire, once writing that every encroachment on rights is not worth a rebellion. And when the Boston Tea Party happened in 1773, he dubbed it an act of violent injustice on our part and insisted that the East India Company should be compensated for its losses. Granted, he had soured on the monarchy by the time he returned to the United States for the Second Continental Congress in 1775, but his past support for King George III earned him the suspicion of many of his fellow patriots. So before he publicly announced his support for American independence, that's what's up with all the spy garbage. He was not a spy. He spent his later years as an abolitionist. He had owned 2 slaves during his life, both of whom worked as household servants, but in his old age, he came to view slavery as a vile institution that ran counter to the principles of the American Revolution. He was president of a Pennsylvania abolitionist society in 1787, and in 1790, he presented a petition to Congress urging it to grant liberty, quote, to those unhappy men who alone in this land of freedom are degraded into perpetual bondage. While the petition was ignored, Franklin kept up the fight until his death a few months later, and even included a provision in his will that required his daughter and son-in-law to free their slaves to get their inheritance. And finally, on the topic of his will, he left £2,000 to Boston and Philadelphia, respectively, with the caveat that they couldn't touch it for 100 years, during which time the money was to be placed in a trust and only used to provide loans to local tradesmen. But after the 100 years was up, the cities could use it as they saw fit. They followed Franklin's wishes, and by 1990, their funds were worth $4.5 million and $2
million. Dang!
The cities have since used the windfall to help finance the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia and the Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology in Boston. So, I hope your hair is blown back. I hope you are at least to some degree in awe of this person. For the main story, let's now go back to when he's being sent to Europe by the Continental Congress, specifically when he's in England. And I confess, I've buried the lead. Because the one thing that I didn't mention in our rundown of interesting things is possibly the most interesting of all. And that is, whilst across the pond, dearest Benjamin Franklin was probably a member of a sex cult.
Okay. All right.
Remember how his parents' big concerns were like, oh, shucks, Ben, you'd have been a great preacher, and, you know, those kids and the Freemasons are bad influences? Yeah, that was their big concern? Okay. Like his father, Ben loved to bone. He was a ladies' man. Ladies?
I have heard that.
I had not heard that before I got into all this. Because, look, I don't want to cast aspersions, but every portrait I've ever seen of him, granted, he does have that kind of Mona Lisa twinkle in his eye, which is hard to convey in a painting. So I had noticed that, like, you know, mischievous, like he was up to something. But I never thought of him as a ladies' man. But he was. And I don't just mean in his younger years, though there was this one little anecdote about him macking on the mistress of a friend of his when he was a teenager. But this was his Achilles heel, as it were, his entire life, even when he was getting pretty long in the tooth. Quote, even when he was old and rotund, Ben had sex appeal. More than two centuries after his death, people are still trying to figure out how a paunchy, balding, bifocaled septuagenarian managed to get ladies in a flutter. From his days as an ambitious young printer in Philadelphia to his years as a diplomatic superstar, Ben Franklin surrounded himself with adoring women, often much younger, usually attractive, and preferably intelligent. Now, by all accounts, Deborah put up with his flirting. He wasn't subtle about it, and she didn't go overseas with him, probably because she had no desire to do all the socializing shit and seeing him being all flirty up close, since, as one of my sources put it, one thought was that he was charming the women so they'd speak favorably about him to their husbands or if they were mistresses of powerful men, and thus it would kind of loosen those men up on his stance on American independence, which is a weird thought to me. I can't understand why they'd be jazzed about this dude from America being all schmoozy with their ladies. But anyhow, Deborah was a badass bitch because, amongst other things, such as basically being a single mom for more than a few years, she assumed the role of postmaster while he was gone. She fought off some rioters once, and, my favorite, as their letters got shorter and more infrequent because, you know, they were growing apart since he was gone a ton of the time, she starts signing them off, your A dash capital letters, feck dash Shanette wife. So, feck, F-E-C-K. In other words, fuck you. I love it. Deborah dies in 1774, and after that, there's a series of specific mistresses. I mean, we know their names and their stories behind there. There's letters and whatnot for proof, and you can read more about those in a Time magazine article that I'll link for you. But it's not just them. It's well known and documented about all of his, I mean, let's just say it, his whoring about. There was even a verse that went around about him that went, Franklin, though plagued with fumbling age, needs nothing to excite him, but is too ready to engage when younger arms invite him. And as one of my sources put it, quote, Franklin's libido was apparently so strong, he himself was scared of it. In his autobiography, he confessed, the hard-to-be-governed passion of my youth had hurried me frequently into intrigues with low women that fell in my way. Of his youth. Just
always got a bone.
and just your youth, huh, Ben? Sure. My favorite piece of documentation is a little something he wrote in 1745, which, quote, had been known in certain circles but kept under wraps for almost 200 years, a letter offering advice to a young man who was having trouble with his own insatiable libido. He gave it a title, like you do, which was Advice to a Young Man on the Choice of a Mistress. Allow me to treat you to a bit of what that letter contained, and it may be the best thing I'll ever read on this podcast. In all your amours, you should prefer old women to young ones. You call this a paradox and demand my reasons. They are these. Because, as they have more knowledge of the world and their minds are better stored with observations, their conversation is more improving and more lastingly agreeable, as when women cease to be handsome, they study to be good. Because there is no hazard of children, which, irregularly produced, may be attended with much inconvenience. Because, through more experience, they are more prudent and discreet in conducting an intrigue to prevent suspicion. The commerce with them is therefore safer with regard to your reputation. Because the sin is less. The debauching of a virgin may be her ruin and make her life unhappy. And, I have to interject here, I have not once met a man, or at least they've never admitted it, and I mean a grown-ass man, I don't mean in the age range of legally being an adult, but I have never met one, or been with one who has ever been even remotely interested in being the one to take the training wheels off the bicycle, so to speak. And I mean, I'm calling bullshit on his being all, oh, it's less sinful. I submit it's because it's far less enjoyable, which actually comes up in the next point. And what a point it is. Because in every animal that walks upright, the deficiency of the fluids that fill the muscles appears first in the highest part. The face first grows lank and wrinkled, then the neck, then the breasts and arms. The lower parts, continuing to the last, as plump as ever. So, that covering all above with a basket.
I am like, shocked face. Wherever this sentence is going.
So, that covering all above with a basket, and regarding only what is below the girdle, it is impossible of two women to know an old from a young one. And, as in the dark, all cats are gray, the pleasure of corporeal enjoyment with an old woman is at least equal, and frequently superior. And lastly, because they are so grateful.
Okay.
Just put a basket on her head, son. Pussy's pussy. Oh my God. And there's the,
especially if it's in the dark. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, there's this cool invention called the dark, and in the dark, all cats are gray.
Okay. You know, as you're going through this list, I'm like, all right. As a non-youngin myself, I'm like, all right. He would appreciate me. You know, like, I'm okay with this. This is cool. And then it gets into the, oh, well, you know, her face is going to be wrinkly, but her cooch is still going to be pretty tight. Like, dude, you're just going to put a basket? No. Ben, you could totally be down with the older women. Yeah, cool. But dude.
I hope the basket thing was like a metaphor for, I don't know what, but I'm hoping it was some sort of metaphor to stick a basket on her head.
Yeah, you know, you're flipping up her skirt and that's just, I don't know.
Written records are not all we have regarding evidence of the whoring. There is a sketchbook on display at the Museum of the American Philosophical Society as part of their Curious Revolutionaries, the Peels of Philadelphia exhibit by one Charles Wilson Peel, a popular artist. When he was still an unknown, he goes to London to study with another artist in 1767, and quote, Peel hoped to build his network of connections and possible commissions by calling on other more established Americans also in London. Among those was Benjamin Franklin, already a celebrated diplomat, philosopher, and bon vivant. Like all artists, Peel also carried his sketchbook with him wherever he went, including social calls. I suspect you all may know what's coming. There are two sketches of Franklin. The caption reads, while studying art in London, Charles Wilson Peel called upon Benjamin Franklin uninvited. Peel accidentally witnessed the well-known Franklin engaging in promiscuous behavior with a lady. Instead of leaving, Peel secretly sketched the scandalous scene for future generations.
Ooh.
Both sketches will be in show notes, but to paint the proverbial picture for you, or sketch it, as it were, let me be clear that these were not, like, done via this kid peeking through a keyhole or a window or hiding behind a curtain or at a distance. The perspective is straight on and up close. I know the caption says secretly, but poor shit. They knew he was there.
They put out a show.
And they didn't care. And it's Ben in a chair, and she's perched beside him in one, kinda on his lap in another. They're both fully dressed, by the way. And in the first, she's got her hand on his crotch, and he's got a hand on her boob. Then in the other, his hand's going for her crotch. I don't know what he hoped to accomplish through all the skirts and petticoats or whatever, but maybe he was just that good. Here's my thing, though. My knee-jerk reaction is that he wasn't laying the pipe as frequently as he was being handsy, and I say that because he was going and doing and staying involved in shit well into his late 70s and early 80s, and he was kicking it until he was 84, and to be sure, I chalk that up primarily to awesome genes, but I just, if he was buttering biscuits that voraciously, statistically, he'd likely have contracted at least a couple of STDs, and chances are he probably did have at least one, but he clearly didn't have syphilis, Swiss cheese brain, is my point. From what I read, based on the symptoms that were documented, that is, it sounds like he probably died of congestive heart failure. But regardless, the bottom line is this, and I'll defer to Albert Henry Smith here, who compiled Ben Ben's documents into the book, The Writings of Benjamin Franklin, in 1905, where he says in the introduction, quote, "It is no use blinking the fact that Franklin's animal instincts and passions were strong and rank, that they led him to the commission of many deplorable errata in his life, and that the taint of an irredeemable vulgarity is upon much of his conduct." Put plainly, Benjamin Franklin was many things, and Horn Dog was amongst them.
Fair enough. All right.
So in his socializing and diplomatic work in England, Ben got acquainted and later became friends with a dude named Sir Francis Dashwood. And later on, he was sort of Ben's superior for a time, because when the colonies were still under British rule and Ben had that postmaster gig, Dashwood served as one of the joint postmasters general of Great Britain. They also shared similar political views, one of my sources noting that Dashwood was supportive of American independence, mentioning that at one point he'd actually drawn up a, quote, "plan of reconciliation to avert the impending war." And also that, quote, "Dashwood nearly ruined himself trying to help Franklin obtain support for the American colonists." But anyway, they exchanged lots of correspondence, and Franklin visited Dashwood's home on multiple occasions, writing to his son during one of his visits in August of 1773, quote, "I am in this house as much at my ease as if it was my own, and the gardens are paradise. But a pleasanter thing is the kind countenance, the facetious and very intelligent conversation of mine host, who, having been for many years engaged in public affairs, seen all parts of Europe, and kept the best company in the world, is himself the best existing." So, you know, high praise, and it sounds like good times. And you best believe it. On this note of effusive praise from the esteemed Founding Father, let me tell you about Francis Dashwood. He was the 11th Baron Le de Spencer, a title which means nothing to me because I don't understand the significance, but whatever. He was in the hoity-toity crowd. He was born in London in December 1708 and was an only child, attended Eton, which to my understanding remains a prestigious school to this day, and when he's 15, his father dies, and that's when he inherits the title. And here they call it the Baronetcy of Dashwood of West Wycombe. So I'm not tracking with that. I guess he had multiple titles, question mark, don't know, not particularly relevant to the story. What is relevant is that amongst his inheritance is this awesome home and property in West Wycombe. Quote, "West Wycombe House is a Palladian-style mansion standing above a swan-shaped lake in splendid park dotted with Greek and Roman temples in this Buckinghamshire village about 30 miles west of London." Pretty swank digs, and that's the place Franklin referred to in that letter. So when he's 21, Dashwood goes on this huge tour of Europe, hobnobbing with artists and philosophers and touring historical sites, and he loves history and ancient stuff, more on that in a second, and he got up to some other things too. He had a tutor along with him, and quote, "In the words of his distracted tutor, Dashwood fornicated his way across Europe," and that he, quote, "caused scandals from St. Petersburg to Constantinople." Now, not a lot of details on said fornicating, but there's a couple instances that I must tell you about regarding that mention of St. Petersburg. And I'm just going to read here from author Daniel Mannix's book on all this, which, by the way, is my primary source for the majority of what you're about to hear. Quote, "Possibly Dashwood's most outstanding feat was to seduce Empress Anne of Russia while disguised as Charles XII of Sweden. Sir Francis turned up at the Russian court elaborately tricked out as King Charles and speaking a sort of gibberish which he claimed was Swedish. As the real Charles XII had died earlier, it's hard to believe that the Empress was honestly fooled by the young lord, but Anne was fond of dashing men, especially if they had the reputation of being experts in bed." According to all accounts, she went along with the gag. The story is an interesting example of how Sir Francis, even as a young man, loved make-believe. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did. Continuing, Mannix says, quote, "After leaving Russia, Sir Francis and his long-suffering tutor went on to Turkey, where Sir Francis exhibited the staying powers of a stallion and the impetuosity of a bull. He dressed in Turkish robes, wore a jeweled scimitar, and sat on a heap of cushions smoking a hookah while beautiful girls hired for the occasion, nude to the waist and wearing gossamer trousers, paraded before him."
What the hell? What is this guy's life? Holy shit. Okay.
Oh, get ready. As another of my sources puts it, "Statesman and merchant venturer, theologian and rogue, landowner and dilettante, Sir Francis managed to combine public service with private pleasure in a manner which no other politician has since been able to emulate or even contemplate. Further, from yet another source, the scion of a fabulously wealthy aristocratic family, Dashwood is a mass of contradictions, connoisseur, intellectual, humanitarian landowner, and shameless debauchee. Rapist, sodomite, condemns one writer. Gentleman, scholar, notes another. And then in yet another place, it just flat out calls him a rake, which is defined as follows. In a historical context, a rake, short for rake hell, analogous to hellraiser, was a man who was habituated to immoral conduct, particularly womanizing. I mean, they nailed it. So, talking about his love of ancient stuff that I mentioned earlier, he was into the religious, ritual parts of it. And for instance, in Italy, he would spend a lot of time touring catacombs and medieval chapels and at the temples and at ruins of Roman villas. And he gets into religion for a little while, but not really. There's this mix of reverence sometimes and mocking other times. Like I say, it's more the ritualistic aspect that he likes. And dare I say, maybe even the community. But regarding one of those mocking aspects of it, he actually, and at the Sistine Chapel of all places, scared the shit out of parishioners when he dressed up in this long, dark hooded cloak, then walked to the front of the sanctuary like he was going to kneel and pray, then flips around and brings out a whip and is snapping it and screaming, "You wish to do penitence? I'll give you penitence." And he's throwing in obscene words too, because of course, and the congregation starts running and screaming, "Il diabolo," because they thought he was the devil. He gets thrown out, and then later, after more raising hell, quote, "After his escapade in the Sistine Chapel, the police had determined that this young man, lord or not, would have to leave the country. He and his tutor were put on board a ship bound for England and told not to return." So,
so dramatic. Oh my gosh.
I hope we've all got a solid bead on this dude. I hope I've given you something to work with. Pictures and show notes, of course, and he's just got this permanent smirk or outright huge-ass grin on his face. So we're now back home in England, and old Francie ain't discouraged. He's motivated, and he, quote, "decided to found a club. Not an association of crude hooligans, but a club that would attract the best and brightest minds in England. The main emphasis of the club would be on sex and drink. Sex and drink of the most involved and esoteric kind."
Are you looking for a history podcast to grab some quotes for a last-minute paper? Or maybe your presentation on Jane Eyre needs a punch-up?
Then do not listen to us.
Do not.
Like, we're begging of you.
I'm Ashley.
And I'm Kelsey. And we host Make It Modern, a podcast where we talk about history, literature, and all things made before the year 2010 in a way that would probably be frowned upon by any teacher.
We basically delve into the past and stumble into the present.
We discuss things like what type of rosé is appropriate for a medieval execution,
and how we've all been Bingley'd one time or another.
So if you love hearing about people, places, and things with so many issues they could be a Julia Michaels song, join us every Thursday on Spotify and iTunes.
And be sure to follow us on Facebook at Make It Modern, and also on Twitter and Instagram at capital MIM underscore podcast.
His claim to fame is one particular iteration of his clubs, and we're getting there. And yeah, I said clubs, plural, because he founded two upon his return, and quote, "Both clubs mix their scholarly meetings with exuberant bouts of drinking, whoring, and wearing a fancy dress." This wasn't some big secret, by the way. They met in public places like inns or pubs or whatever, and although in the near future he became a member of parliament, nobody ever respected him or liked his ideas, so at this point, who cares? And they talked a big game about it being scholarly or whatever, but let's just cut to the chase, as one of my sources does. The objects of the club were wine, women, and profane song.
Drinking and fucking and songs about fucking.
That's exactly right. Now, in years past, there had been a more, let's say, extreme version of these types of clubs, and a particular one was called the Hellfire Club. And again, met basically in a public place at an old inn called Georgian Vulture, where, yes, there was actually a stuffed vulture. Just thought I'd throw that in there. And it ultimately got abolished by the High Lord Chancellor because, quote, "even in that broad-minded time, the members had carried things a little too far when they celebrated mass on the body of a naked girl stretched out on one of the barroom tables," which I get the impression that actually means woman and that they're being patronizing. Anyway, as you can imagine, Francis was loving this more extreme version, and he wanted to have a club like this of his own, because it seems like his other clubs either disbanded or kind of fading away, or people dropped out, or whatever. He didn't call this new iteration the Hellfire Club, but that's what people refer to it as because A, it's fun, and B, it's basically appropriate given their activities mirrored that original Hellfire Club in many ways. What he called himself and the initial 12 members, and more on the members in a second, was the Friars of St. Francis of Wycombe. He's declared himself a saint. I kind of love it. But I mean, it is facetiously because, again, a lot of this is based in mocking the Catholic Church. He started hosting meetings, parties, let's get real, at that stuffed Vulture Inn. Then they started doing it on this little island in the Thames, but they wanted their own big facility. And in 1752, bingo, there was this ruined medieval abbey called Medmenham Abbey. It's spelled Medmenham, but it's pronounced Mednum. Don't ask me why. That had been built in 1160, had been deserted for forever, and Francis buys it. The location was perfect because it was only about 6 miles from his West Wycombe estate, and it was in this grove that was surrounded by trees, and it had this kind of stream branching off from the Thames that ran beside it. And the members, oh, by the way, they also referred to themselves as monks, hearty har har, they ain't monks. They would arrive by boat because it was more sneaky and creepy. And he definitely wanted things to have a creepy vibe. So when he's restoring the abbey, he has it designed to where the exterior still looks like ruins. Outside at the entrance, he's got carved in Latin a phrase that means, do what thou wilt. And there's a statue of Harpocrates, who is the Egyptian god of silence, as well as a statue of Volupian Angerona, the goddess of secret passion, holding their fingers to their lips. And then he really dolled up the interior. There are stained glass windows depicting the members in naughty poses, and on the ceiling is a brightly colored fresco that was described as pornographic, but unfortunately, we don't know details. Though we do have documentation that one of the members, and again, it ain't like these dudes are at all prudish, one of the members called it, quote, unspeakable. So I can't imagine. I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
There's this long, fancy black marble altar in their, air quotes, sacred chapel area. There's tons of rooms with fancy couches. There's a huge-ass wine cellar. Everywhere there's racy Roman and Egyptian-themed decor, vulgar tapestries. You get the idea. But one room in particular was really super special. A library which had a ton of religious and culty books, sure, but also contained, quote, what was generally admitted to be the finest collection of pornographic books in Great Britain. Now, I have to stop here for a second. The porn was multitude at this time, but one specific type I wanted to mention are the whore dialogues, and they are, quote, a literary genre of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, and a type of erotic fiction. Such works typically concern the sexual education of a naive younger woman by an experienced older woman, and often included elements of philosophizing, medical folklore, satire, and anti-clericalism. The later works in this genre, such as that by Courier, indulge in a more sophisticated type of sexual fantasy and are the precursors of the more explicit pornography which followed in Europe. And the person Courier that they mention is Nicholas Courier, who in 1740 published a little classic called A Dialogue Between a Married Lady and a Maid, which by maid they mean maiden as in virgin, and the summary is, innocent Octavia is about to marry her beloved. It is up to Tolia, an older, married woman, to explain the mysteries of marriage.
Okay.
Full disclosure, one of the supplemental things you'll see in show notes is a video from BuzzFeed's Ruining History several years ago when they covered the Hellfire Club, and they read some bits from this absolute work of art. So I'm totally cribbing off their genius and will now ask you, my darling Tiff, to open up the document I emailed to you and delight us with some examples of erotica of this time period.
Oh boy. Okay. All right. So I just get to read these?
You just as written. Yep.
All right. Here we go.
Hi there. It's me, the text-to-speech guy. Nash and Tiff asked me to let you know that while the podcast is already marked as explicit, from here on out things get pretty racy. So consider this an extra caution for those of you listening within the vicinity of potentially innocent ears. Adults only from this point forward. You have been warned.
This is Octavia, the young virgin, speaking. He laid me upon the couch upon which I sat, and he put his right hand under my dress. Having turned up my dress a little above my knees, he began to feel my thighs. And if you had seen how his eyes sparkled, then, lifting his hand up, he took hold of that place which distinguishes us from men. This place, said he, will make me the happiest man in the world. He put his finger into the slit, which is a very little one, and immediately, opening my legs with force, he threw himself between them. flat on his face. To tell the truth, from that day forwards, he was infinitely more pleasing unto me.
I bet he was, honey.
Uh-huh. Good for you, Octavia. Good for you. Okay. In another passage, says Tullia, the older married woman, first I will describe unto thee the man's member, then I will tell you the use thereof. There is between the thighs, just at the bottom of the belly, a piece of flesh, which, when it is not employed for our pleasure, hangs loose, bobbing here and there. But when our beauty excites it, stands hard and firm. In ordinary men, 'tis about 7 or 8 of their own thumb's breadth long when it stands. But in those whom nature has favored, 'tis about 10 or 11 of their thumb's breadth long. Underneath hangs in a bag or purse 2 little balls, pretty hard, and the harder the better. In them is contained that thick white liquor. And Octavia replies, oh, I believe he has a good stock of it, for he wet all my belly and my dress with that warm shower. Ew. Ew. With that warm shower. It sounds like he peed on her, to be honest.
It sounds like he has crappy aim, or like bring a towel. Like, I don't know. Something.
Don't ruin a dress. How dare he?
Don't ruin the dress, man. So I've linked you all. Thank you, by the way, for your participation.
Yeah, I was. I'm glad you told me not to read that beforehand, because that was definitely interesting.
That was a treat, right? Now, I've linked you to this work in its entirety in show notes, by the way, if you are curious, listeners. And what cracks me up is how almost demure the author is in describing some stuff, you know, the anatomy and all that. But then sprinkled all throughout, he's outright saying fuck and cunt and prick. There's these little dashes for certain letters, but I mean, them's the words. Okay, back to the Abbey. And now it is time to tell you of the members and their ceremonies. Oh, and I'll briefly note here, talking about the people who were allowed at the Abbey and at the meetings, there were outsiders of a sort. Francis did employ a staff to serve food and wait on people, and I'll tell you about some other members of the staff in just a few moments. But the members. So it expanded beyond the original 12. I saw one list that was maybe 15. I can't remember. But anyway, here's a couple of the notable ones. There was, quote, Chevalier Dion, the sexually ambiguous cross-dressing French spy, and George Selwyn, the 18th century's own necrophiliac gentleman sadist.
Oh, no.
Holy shit. And then there was this guy named John Wilkes, who was described as a journalist, politician, and radical, as well as John Montague, the 4th Earl of Sandwich. And just real quick about old Sandwich, quote, the Earl of Sandwich, the most notorious rake of the whole lot, and no, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go with the necrophiliac for that, but okay, notorious rake of the whole lot, who boasted that he specialized in seducing virgins because he enjoyed the corruption of innocence. Dude, you should be hitting some gray cat. Like, what are you thinking? But I bring up Montague and Wilkes for a reason. We'll come back to them. But first, we need to talk about a typical meeting of the Hellfire Club. To give you a little taste up front, quote, the chief voluptuary, Sir Francis, corpulent and red-faced in middle age, would be dressed in a red robe trimmed with rabbit fur, according to a 1779 account called Nocturnal Revels, which purports to be the work of a former member, each friar was allowed to invite a lady of cheerful, lively disposition to improve the general hilarity. And elaborating upon that, quote, aristocratic women would travel from London to join the frolics dressed as nuns, and comely local nymphs were hired, allegedly to lie naked on his altar so the monks could lick holy wine from their navels. An exciting aperitif before the real festivities began. Yeah, I mean, tradition. Hello, tradition. We've talked about this. Backing up, let's start with the arrival of the members and their ladies. And I must admit, this entry sounds incredible. The meetings were always held at night, naturally, and they'd get there via river, as I said earlier, and it was in this huge bright red gondola. They'd get duded up in their white robes that had red-lined hoods and hold candles as they walked to the abbey as a bell rung in the tower and organ music played. Best believe there was an organ, because you can't not have an organ when creepiness is involved, you know?
Yeah, naturally.
Quote, boatmen on the river and travelers who had lost their way occasionally witnessed the spectacle. Most of them thought that the spirits of dead monks were returning to their abbey and promptly fled, which was exactly what the club members wanted them to do. Nice. At the door, they'd be met by Francis, who had asked them the password, and apparently it was the same thing every time, which was the phrase, do what thou wilt, and not terribly secretive, since, as mentioned, that's the engraving above the door. But look, I'm being picky, and I'm being judgy. There are other things to judge. So they each took turns, being what was basically the MC of a given meeting, calling it the abbot of the day. And this dude, quote, arranged the menu, selected the drinks, and organized the entertainment of the evening. He also had first pick of the women. But hold on. Gotta have the opening ceremony, where Francis hands out glasses shaped like horns, and they toast to the powers of darkness with brandy as a gong is struck. Now, about this, there was...
This is elaborate.
Oh, it's very... Yeah, listen, if you're gonna do something, I mean... Now, about this, there was some Satanism stuff mixed in, but it doesn't seem like they were serious. They were just dicking around. It was more for poking fun at religion. There are records of them celebrating the Black Mass, and yeah, that's a thing associated with Satanism, but this was done as more of a parody of a Catholic Mass. Francis had gotten a book about black magic on the down low because books on the occult were banned, just like erotica and porn were. So again, this falls into the whole, ooh, we're deviant, we're breaking the law, we're wild and crazy. Just frankly, adolescent-minded stuff. But in any event, that's where all their ideas for their ceremonies started from. And if I may be so bold as to speak on Stan's behalf, as he's a friend of the show since episode one, this is A-okay, and I think we've demonstrated that while eccentric, Stan has a great sense of humor.
I'd agree.
You'd agree?
Definitely.
Stan is, by the way, what we call Satan, for those who don't know. Here's how their black mass went. They'd drape the chapel room in black, and there were these faux missals, which, for those of you who don't know, are books with the text used in Catholic masses. And I say faux because instead of that, they were full of what's described as obscene parodies of the scriptures. They did the thing with the chick laid out naked and did shots from her navel, you know, from the huge marble altar, and they're calling the shots sacrificial wine. There's the usual black candles, inverted crucifix, and you know how they burn incense during Catholic Mass?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, this here wasn't exactly incense. They were burning belladonna and hemlock, those are poisonous, y'all, and verbena and mandrake, all of which, when inhaled, can act on the body like a narcotic. They are high as Ben Franklin's kites. And no, I haven't forgotten our beloved Benji boy. Here's the part I love. There's also lamps scattered around. Quote, lamps of lewd design were used. One in the shape of a monster bat with an erect penis is still preserved in the Witchcraft Museum on the Isle of Man.
And excellent.
You have to have some singing. So ahead of time, they'd write dirty rhymes set to the tunes of traditional religious hymns. We have now arrived at sexy times. After this opening ceremony, into another room they go, where all the ladies are, in masks and dressed as nuns. And the masks were not just for funsies, it was to keep them anonymous on purpose because of who some of them were. Now, a lot of them were those aforementioned upper-class women, though most were professional sex workers, and some were middle-class, like daughters of local merchants who were jazzed about bumping nasties with nobility. But, and a big but, quote, most surprising of all, a few of the nuns were wives, sisters, or even mothers of the monks. So, yep, there was incest.
Oh.
I know. After whoever was playing the abbot of the day got his first pick, everyone would pair or group off, some to different rooms, some out in the garden, but usually a good handful of them would stay in that main room because they wanted to watch each other get it on. And quote, the members spoke proudly of the amoristic acrobats of some of the women and described the various positions in great detail. Some of them required 3 or 4 people working as a team to perform.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
In addition, if you think they didn't have some props, you'd be incorrect. Quoting again, one device which was provided for the ladies was called the lustful toy. This was a rooster hobby horse with the beak in the form of a phallus, the bird's neck being stretched and turned around so it laid upon its back. It was for the nuns to ride to get up their passion.
Okay. All right.
Speaking of getting up, the abbey also had an apothecary full of aphrodisiacs so the monks could keep standing at attention, as it were, so they could keep threading that needle with as many gals for as long as possible. And hell yes, they kept score. You better believe. On that semi-medical note, I mentioned staff earlier, and part of the staff included a physician and a midwife, and for a couple reasons, one being to mix up the bootleg Viagra, and another to, quote, revive the members who passed out. I also get the impression that the midwife might have administered some homemade Plan B, because I can't figure why else she'd be there unless there was maybe some sort of hoo-ha injury, maybe? But she had another off-site purpose. When the women would turn up pregnant, as of course you'd expect would happen, she'd deliver the babies, and then, good Lord, quote, the children born to the nuns were called the sons and daughters of St. Francis, and as they grew up, they were given jobs around the abbey. I hope in daylight. I hope not at the ceremonies.
Oh.
Can you imagine? I hope they were just like weeding and gardening or, I don't know, picking up discarded toys. I'd even allow that, as long as they weren't present for the deed.
Mm-hmm.
Then the physician had an off-site job as well. He was the one the members went to when their, members got out of sorts with STDs. And it seems like it wasn't a big deal for them because, quote, they used to address each other as Senor Gonorrhea and Monsieur Syphilis.
Oh.
I'm dying.
Oh my God.
Well, and so were they. All right. Now they're hungry. They've clearly worked up an appetite, so a banquet's laid out. I just hope they've wiped down the table. They drank like crazy and kept record of who drank the most. There's a wine book that was found where it was recorded that the typical dinner would equate to the men drinking 3 to 4 bottles each. There was also a special punch, God knows what was in it, and then there was the food. Quote, the various dishes had colorful names, breasts of Venus, which were 2 squabs, and I had to look that up, those are baby pigeons of all things, served side by side with a single red cherry on top of each.
Of course.
Of course. You gotta have the nips. And devil's loins, which was roast beef cut in the shape of buttocks.
Okay.
More on the topic of creative names, and back to the drinking, they had cocktails called Gin and Sin, Lay Me Down Softly, and Strip Me Naked. I would try those. The pigeon's not a chance, but the Gin and Sin, oh yeah.
Sounds like a good bachelorette party kind of drink.
It really does. All good things must come to an end, though. And well, this wasn't the total end, but there was an incident that was the beginnings of the end. And oh, what an incident it was. So their meeting nights had a routine, as you have heard, and apparently one member got bored, that Wilkes guy I brought up earlier. He decides to kick things up a notch. At one meeting, he brought a baboon, and he dressed it as the devil and hid it in a box or a chest. I'm sure they thought it was filled with a bunch of sex toys or something, otherwise I can't fathom somebody not asking why he's lugging around what must have been a not unsubstantial sized container. He waits until they're in the middle of their, all capital letters, very serious opening ceremony in the chapel room, and then he springs the lid, and this animal goes bug-fuck crazy. It comes out screaming, and it jumps on the Earl of Sandwich's back, who is then scared shitless, and he starts screaming and runs from the room, shouting, "Spare me, gracious devil! I am as yet but half a sinner! I've never been as wicked as I intended!" Y'all, he thought that
monkey... You're doing all of that, and that's only half?
Right. I mean, y'all, he thought a monkey was the devil. He thought it was Stan. I'm going to call the monkey Stan, matter of fact. End quote. Sandwich never forgave Wilkes, whose prank marked the last time the Hellfire Club met at the Abbey. Why? I don't know. I also don't know where the hell Wilkes obtained a freaking baboon. Anyway, one place said that they fed the baboon table scraps, but I also recall another place saying it jumped out a window and was never seen again. Godspeed, Stan. Godspeed. But never fear. Francis always has a plan. The Abbey's out, but caves are in. You heard me? Caves, y'all. He is upping the spooky ante. Francis has a cave system dug into a chalk hill that's a few hundred yards from his estate. And this sounds incredibly dangerous to me, but he did it right. They're solid, they're safe to be in, and to this day, you too can tour them.
Can you bone in them?
No.
Oh, not worth it.
Sadly, there's no bone tours.
I was hoping that. All right.
Francis has the entrance to the caves designed with this church facade. And remember I told you he loved those old catacombs in France and Rome. So he's made the interior look like those, with passageways lined with torches, leading to various carved out rooms, done up how they had them at the Abbey. And it's huge. The main tunnel is like a quarter mile long. There's a dressing room off of the beginnings of it. And then, quote, beyond, the tunnel slopes steadily downward and deeper into the hill to enter a maze of smaller passages. The main passage reaches the banqueting hall, a large chamber some 40 feet square and about 60 feet high, where the club met and dined.
Holy shit.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. Pictures and show notes, of course. And you know Francis, he's got to have some sort of message at the entrance. And there's one that sounds like it's immediately inside, which reads, sweat and exchange sweat until the marrow of your bones runs out.
He's intense. My God.
That's a lot of pressure, Francis. I'm just saying. And what about Benjamin Franklin? Nash, you say. Why do we think he was involved beyond the fact that he was friends with Francis and visited there multiple times? And because of what we know about Franklin, we can kind of connect the dots within a reasonable margin of error. Fine, you want more? I'll give you more. We know when Franklin visited and stayed at the West Wycombe House. And it just so happens that during at least one such occasion, there is a record of a club meeting happening. Per Mannix, quote, there seems to be no reason why Franklin should have gone to Wycombe at this special time unless he was a member. Only club members were allowed at the estate during club meetings. Second, there's something that Franklin wrote about his time there that smacks of him being familiar with the Hellfire Caves, as they are now known. Quote, the exquisite sense of classical design, charmingly reproduced at West Wycombe, is as evident below the earth as above it. I mean, come on now, y'all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was totally a member. Totally. So what became of the Hellfire Club? Members moved away and or grew older and died off, some from infections related to STDs, according to Mannix. And I don't know if he's assuming that or if he has proof, but I'd call it a fair assumption. And then that whole thing with the monkey, it turned into actual serious beef between Wilkes and Montague. The Earl actually accused Wilkes of a bunch of illegal shit, and in one place, the way it's described, sounds like he might have framed him. But he basically gets Wilkes exiled. Then Wilkes is talking shit about both Sandwich and Francis, so it's possible he ran his mouth about the club. And as for Francis, he's still kind of a screw-up in all his official positions, so he's just holding on with his status and titles. Like I say, nobody really gives a hoot about him. Then they also got found out. Best I can tell, people were aware of his Medmenham Monks Club, but I guess the people involved kept it pretty secret, which astounds me for as many years as they carried on, that nobody talked. But the kicker seems to be this book called Chrysal, or The Adventures of a Guinea, by a Charles Johnstone, which came out in 1760, and it's fiction. It's about the adventures of a guinea coin, don't ask me, but it was hugely popular, and quote, this book sparked the association between the Medmenham monks and the Hellfire Club. It's all online, but hell if I was going to try to read it. It's cumbersome, to say the least. But there's apparently more than a few passages with anecdotes that were clearly about the club and spilled the beans on the rituals, including the monkey story, so bless you, Charles Johnstone, for making that gem public. It wasn't outright said in anything I read, and I didn't have time to go down this road, but I'd be interested to know if there was a connection between the author and one of the members, because he got a lot of detail. In any event, the Hellfire Club is pretty much kaput by the early 1760s.
Wait, how long did it operate?
A good 10 years, I think. Hang on. I'm gonna have to look back.
Sorry.
I'm so far gone with my pages that I'm going to insert text-to-speech guy here to give you guys the exact number. But I think about a decade.
As you have no doubt come to expect, Nash was right. Well, she was close. It is estimated that Dashwood's Hellfire Club met off and on from about 1749 to 1760, though it could be as long as until 1766. Hard to tell, what with it being a secretive organization and all that.
I shall end with this delightful quote. Further details will always be vague. Many years later, a Buckinghamshire historian named Thomas Langley tracked down Sir Francis's elderly housekeeper and quizzed her on the specifics of club meetings. Apparently, he was so horrified by her stories that he decided the information might as well be buried in oblivion. And that is your story of Benjamin Franklin, Francis Dashwood, and the Hellfire Club. Tiff, your thoughts?
Hot damn. That's a lot to take in.
That's what she said.
That's what she said, yeah. As soon as I said it, I heard it.
And you know, I find it interesting. Both of our stories had like little islands off to the way, temporarily, albeit, but... And then that there was orgies, of course, and that it was a family affair, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. You kept saying all these little things. I was like, oh, yeah, we had that and we had that.
There were no peaches.
No peaches. Well, you don't know. They had those pretty big feasts. You don't know if there were peaches or not.
I'm sure there were peaches. Come on now.
Mm-hmm. Peaches and clams.
Hearty har har. Yeah.
Dude needed some better hobbies, I think. That's a lot of time and money and just effort to devote to orgies.
I like that he made it so... I think they knew what they were doing. They were just playing dress up is what's hilarious to me about it. That everybody was going there to bang. But they... I'll be honest, minus the incest part, I really do kind of like it that they made it an event. That they didn't just show up and be gross is relative depending on your perspective, but they made it fun. They
yeah, I mean, if you're gonna go through with it and do all that stuff, you might as well.
There was a baboon. All right, well, I don't know what else there is to say. They had a monkey and they had a rocking horse dildo and they had a, I mean, look. There's just not much more that we can give you guys. I think we might have outdone ourselves with these cult episodes. And that's it. Like we say, keep listening. You'll hear how to get hold of us. We love hearing from you.
We sure do. And this is where the catchphrase goes.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.